Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power, but right now we're going to talk about summer power. Yes, we are going to be traveling via electronic technology to the beautiful state of Florida, and it has just all of this magnificence. More than anything, it has always been portrayed. I can remember from the time I was a little girl as the place you wanted to go to during winter if you were living in the north. You really wanted to be down in Florida where it was warm and sunny, and it's that way right now. We're going to be talking about Florida. This state as a state is quite a fascinating place, and my guest, Rick Kilby, well, he put together a publication called Finding the Fountain of Youth, and we are going to find out about some of the myths that have been associated with this beautiful, beautiful part of the country. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Rick, this is such a fun book. This is really a lot of fun, and I can see where you, being a graphic designer, had a good time putting so much of the material together for this. Why did you decide that you wanted to write about the Fountain of Youth? I mean, this is a subject that has been talked about, I don't know, for how long, and it started with one particular man, supposedly, according to the myth. But why did you decide you were going to tackle this?
I'd like to say that the subject found me. I grew up in Florida, and my dad was a little bit on the cheap side, and so we never got to go to all what we call tourist traps, you know, the roadside attractions that most tourists got to go to. Mm-hmm. So there was one in particular in St. Augustine that I wanted to go to, and that was the Fountain of Youth. So I had an opportunity to go there one Thanksgiving. My family was meeting in St. Augustine, and I went there the day before they got there, and I fell in love with the place. I thought it was incredible because not only was there this kind of roadside kitsch that so many people associate with Florida, but it was a really beautiful site, and because that area had been protected for so long, it preserved some incredible archaeological finds. So on many different levels, it was just a gorgeous spot, and that kind of awakened in me a desire to see other parts of Florida that I'd overlooked before. So after that, I started a blog and kind of made it my quest to go places like this, and part of that was the Fountain of Youth and how the myth had spread and how, you know, kind of artifacts of Ponce de Leon kind of still littered the state years after that kind of fell out of vogue. And it started kind of a multiple-year journey for me to uncover these places.
Well, I can't think of a more enjoyable way to have an excuse to go and say, gee, I got to do this for research, and traveling to different parts of Florida. I really enjoyed your very first graphic that you have in the book. It's a postcard, and it's rectangular. On the left side of the postcard, it has a before. It shows a woman. She's got a red kerchief around her head. She's in a wheelchair, and there is this elderly man who's behind her, and then there is this figure dressed in the attire of Ponce de Leon. And he's pouring this water from the Fountain of Youth into a glass. And then the image on the right side of the postcard is this gorgeous, voluptuous blonde that's doing a tap dance in high heels. You know, she's wearing a bathing suit, obviously. She's in Florida. And she's just gorgeous. And I thought, what a way of advertising.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite artifacts. It's a postcard from the Fountain of Youth in St. Augustine, and it's kind of a before and after. She's seated in a wheelchair with a scarf, and then Ponce pours her a drink from the well of the Fountain of Youth, and the next thing you know, she's young again in the bathing suit, and she's dancing, and that's definitely one of my favorite artifacts.
Now, what is that time frame? Is that about 1920, or is it later?
I think that's probably 30s or 40s.
30s or 40s. Oh, what a hoot. I look at that and I think, my goodness, little has changed because we're still looking for the fountain of youth. And, I mean, with all the commercials on television, the various things you hear, it's something that goes on forever. People want to have that fountain of youth. Okay, let's go back to the 1500s, 1513. Juan Ponce de Leon, that was the beginning, supposedly, of this myth. Tell the myth and then tell what's wrong with it.
Well, actually the roots of the myth go well beyond Ponce de Leon, so that when he came to Florida in 1513, most of the people of Europe probably knew of a myth of a fountain of youth, because the roots go back as far as ancient Greece. And I've been told that there's a Middle Eastern version of the Fountain of Youth myth where it has roots in Egypt. And so it's part of the European popular culture of the time that there's this mystical fountain. So when he came to Florida, you know, historians say today there's no evidence that he was searching for the Fountain of Youth. But what happened is, well after his death, when they were writing the written accounts of his journeys to Florida, one of the historians had a bone to pick with Ponce, and it was all kind of political. So he tried to infer that Ponce had impotence problems and thusly was searching for the Fountain of Youth to restore his potency, I guess I should say, and kind of smeared him. And so it kind of got picked up in other accounts, and, you know, there's no surviving handwritten accounts by any of the people who are actually on the journey. So everything is second and third hand at this point. So it kind of was written by these historians. One was named Oviedo and the other one was Herrera, and it got passed on. And it really was a couple hundred years before it got picked up again by the author who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And his name escapes me right now.
Amazing. There you go. You just never know. And doesn't politics come into so many issues? My goodness.
It does.
Poor old Ponce. It just kept following him, and it kept going, going, and going. Now, you have in this book, Finding the Fountain of Youth, some absolutely interesting stories that I think are just amazing how, I'll call them hucksters, or maybe I should call them PR people. Maybe some PR people would be upset with me if I said that. Let me think. Promoters. Let's use the term promoter. I think that's a good one. You have one in here, a St. Augustine businessman, John Whitney, in the 1870s, said that a spring on his property was the fountain of youth. Okay, was he the beginning of people saying, no, it's in my backyard, it's over here in so-and-so's backyard? How much credence was he given for this, and how did it work for him?
Well, as far as I can tell, that's the first, you know, the first evidence of somebody claiming to have the actual Fountain of Youth back in the 1880s. And he was really your typical Florida real estate salesman trying to sell swampland. And it was just kind of a, you know, here I have the Fountain of Youth, come here, a couple bucks to have a drink from the water of the spring. And I haven't determined if that's located near the Fountain of Youth attraction that still exists today in St. Augustine or not. But that seems to be kind of the epicenter of all things Ponce is St. Augustine. And he was the first in, you know, the big real estate boom of people selling swampland in Florida was really the 1920s. So he was about 40 years before that.
Now, water. Florida has always epitomized beauty, a tropical kind of environment dependent on what area of Florida you're in. There were many indigenous people that lived in Florida, and one of the tribes was the Timucua. Tell us about that tribe and what you found out about them and how long they've been in the area and where were they located?
Well, the Timucua were people who were indigenous to the eastern part of Florida, probably from about Orlando northward up until, you know, the St. Augustine, Jacksonville region. the time Ponce landed in Florida, it's been estimated there's close to 250,000 indigenous people. The Timucua was certainly one of the larger tribes, as was the Colusa and Apalachee and the Panhandle. But, you know, these names that we know them by today are really kind of Spanish versions. We never really know what they call themselves by. Mm-hmm. And they were the prominent tribe when Ponce would have arrived and when in the age of colonial Florida when the Spanish were here. Unfortunately, the Spanish, one of the things they were looking for when they came to Florida was a source of free labor. And they pretty much told these indigenous people they had to work for the Spanish or they would kill them, unfortunately. Right. And so they were kind of forced into slavery, and they had no resistance at all to the diseases the Spanish brought with them. So many of them died in disease, and some of them actually ended up working for the Spanish. And in fact, the first colony in the New World was the Menendez colony in St. Augustine in 1565, and it looks like now the site of that colony was actually where the Fountain of Youth attraction is today, and it was a Timucuan village called Saloy, and that's where he chose to start his colony.
You have, again, so many fun cartoons in this book that actually were published, and one of them was a comic book, The Adventures of Jerry Lewis. When did this come out? I see this is an oldie. Did this come out like in the 50s?
Yes, exactly, 1950s. Yeah, that was one of the funnest things about kind of this journey that I'm on, is finding evidence of the myth in our popular culture, because it's everywhere. You know, Disney did a cartoon in the 1953 called Don and the Fountain of Youth, about Donald Duck discovering the Fountain of Youth, and he goes through Florida and the swamplands and discovers it, and it's so much fun. But I think, you know, every cartoon or television show seems to steal that plot line of the Fountain of Youth, and you can find it again and again and again, and it's been kind of a joy to find it. Bugs Bunny did a version. I have a version in the book that's Captain Crunch that was a prize that came in the cereal, and I kept finding it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still used today by a lot of cartoons and television shows.
Going back into a little bit of history here, many of the indigenous people literally disappeared. They died either from diseases, they might have intermarried, or they might have been killed, because the Spanish were notorious for their brutality when it came to any people that they came across, whether it was in, you know, North America, South America, didn't make any difference. That was just their patterning. And there is so much history, and Florida, I can remember when I was there when I was a kid, the biggest thing I really became aware of was the size of the bugs. Well, anytime you're in the tropical environment, it's really amazing. And, of course, every day at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be raining either in the front yard or the backyard. You could set your clock by the time that the rains happened. Now, when I was in Florida, I was at Disney World, and I can remember talking to someone that was a driver and said, oh, my goodness, it used to be that way, but the weather has now changed in Florida. Florida has been known for its beauty, but it really has become heavily populated. What is it like there now as far as the water and the natural environment? So much of it has disappeared, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, it's ironic that, you know, the very myth of the Fountain of Youth has been used for years to promote Florida as a place kind of rejuvenation and fresh starts. And, you know, it's lured people down here almost too well. And the state has become much more populated. I believe it's the third or fourth highest populated state in the country now. And as a result, a lot of our natural resources have been depleted. I think the state has done a fairly good job of trying to set aside private or lands for the public and not developing them. But as a result of the increased population, there's more demand on fresh water. Most of the fresh water that we use as drinking water comes from an aquifer that's beneath the state called the Floridan Aquifer, which is really made up about almost a quadrillion gallons of water, which you could never use all that water up. But in reality, we're starting to tap too much of it that the resource is starting to diminish, and we're starting to springs drying up and lakes drying up and having some of those kind of problems. And it's very unfortunate, and we're going to have to make some tough choices in the future about how we're going to get our fresh drinking water.
I think this is something that many parts of the world are experiencing because of size of populations, not understanding how they can sort of recycle things. And we are in an era that is demanding that we become aware of how to take care of the environments that we're living in so that they stay healthy. And it is a process. Now, part of what caused the heavy population to come into Florida, because let's face it, when you go into the tropics, when it was in its original form, unless you were an indigenous person, it wasn't a fun place to be. I mean, you look at these people that so-called discovered it. They were of the Victorian era, before that, actually, but women having their long skirts and the heavy clothing. I mean, we'd look at these photos and examples and drawings today, and we just laugh. We said, oh, my goodness, how do people live like that? Well, they left during the summer months. They weren't there during the summer months when it was exceptionally hot and humid. But there were two railroad magnates, Henry Flagler and Henry Plant. Interesting. They both had the same first name, and they were railroad magnates. And it's because of them that there was this beginning flow of people coming into the so-called paradise state. Give us a little information about these two guys.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. You know, Florida was first discovered by Europeans in 1513, but it really, not a whole lot happened until the late 1800s because it was just, you know, it was swampland for the most part. So the coastal regions developed somewhat, but there was no way to get around. You know, there were no roads. So Flagler and Plant really opened up the state. Flagler went along the east coast of the state, and starting in St. Augustine, he actually came down with his wife because it was a place known for invalids who were trying to recover mm-hmm. their health. And went there and fell in love with the place. So he started and he built a hotel, coincidentally called Hotel Ponce de Leon, and started working his way south. Meanwhile, Henry Plant started working on the west coast, and he kind of cut across the middle of the state, not too far from Orlando, and built this beautiful hotel that's still in Tampa Bay, was known as the Hotel Tampa Bay, that's now the University of Tampa, in a similar architectural style that Henry Flagler used. But because of that, the original tourists started coming down in winter months and enjoying the Florida weather. And Henry Flagler really didn't stop with his railroad till he got all the way to Key West. And that overseas railroad through the Keys just almost killed him because it was such an effort. And he died not long after it was opened. Whereas I think Henry Plant went as far as Punta Rossa, which is Fort Myers. But those two are kind of pioneers in opening up the state.
Now, there are areas of Florida that are known for their wonderful mineral springs, but I loved the comment that you made in your book. You said, but Florida itself was an invention. It was by Beth Dunlop. Florida itself was an invention, a tropical wonderland built on swamp and muck by canny and imaginative entrepreneurs. And boy, Disney was one of those entrepreneurs, because Disney World is down there, and it's huge.
Yeah, the area that Disney occupies is known as the Reedy Creek District, and it's really the size of a county, and they're autonomous and self-governing, and he's just one of the more recent examples of people who have come and kind of reshaped Florida. And, you know, I think part of that is because it took so long to get developed, that, you know, people saw it as a land of opportunity that they could, you know, make their mark on it. And I think that kind of attitude still persists to this day. And it, you know, kind of began with the two Henrys, Plant and Flagler, and Disney. And I think people are still coming to Florida to make their marks today.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the big accomplishments for the state of Florida was the citrus growth of oranges, you know, lemons, grapefruit, this type of thing. And there was a Dr. Philip Phillips in 1894 that started all of this. I did not know it went that far back. I always thought California was the place for oranges. And, of course, that went away as California started developing. The orange groves that were there en masse, well, they're no longer there now. They're all replaced by homes and freeways and that type of thing. But Florida has been significant in the citrus industry. How was it that Dr. Phillips got involved with this?
Dr. Phillips was one of the growers in this area where I am in Orlando who really tried to tie citrus to the healthful benefits. And he kind of used his name as a doctor, and his, you know, his slogan was, "The doc says it's good for you." And the citrus industry itself goes back again to the, you know, those Victorian times in the late 1800s, but there was a series of two devastating freezes in a row, so that the citrus industry had to move further south. And there still is a very robust citrus industry in Florida, but it's mostly to the southern parts of the state, because when the freezes happen, the citrus doesn't handle it very well. And the industry itself really kind of leapt on that whole myth of Florida as being a place of health and youth, and kind of took it to the next level. And the irony of it is the first citrus was brought to Florida by the conquistadors, the Spanish conquistadors, who had the citrus and brought it with them because it was really good to prevent scurvy on the voyages across the Atlantic. And they probably spit out seeds here, and they saw that the citrus grew. And so it all goes back to the conquistadors again.
Now, Florida had what they called a silver revolution, and it's still going on today. And I know last year my husband and I, because we have family that's down in Florida, we had the occasion to visit the area, and we were stunned. We were absolutely stunned at how populated it was and how much was going on. I mean, you didn't feel like you were in any place different than being at home, other than the temperature and the humidity. It was amazing. All the fast food restaurants, everything was right there. You weren't missing out on much of anything. It has developed so incredibly more than I had ever imagined it to be, and that was just my own naive positioning, because I hadn't been there in so long. Talk to us about the silver revolution and how that has affected the state.
I would trace the origin of the whole retiree phenomenon probably back to after World War II, as the middle class started to develop. For the first time, people had the means to retire and to, you know, not work until, you know, they died, you know, so they had this opportunity to spend their senior years in a different location, and they had the means to do that. So a lot of GIs trained for World War II in Florida. So after the war, they started saying, "I want to go back. You know, this is a really, really wonderful place." And so that's when it kind of began, and it started a phenomenon. And I think the city that's most closely tied to retirees is St. Pete, where they had those famous green benches where all the senior citizens would sit. And in fact, the city got tired of that reputation at one point. They got rid of the green benches because they got tired of being tied with the whole phenomena of senior citizens, and they were afraid that was tarnishing their image. But there are whole areas that are basically dedicated to that. You know, to this day, there's a large area called the Villages that takes up parts of four different counties that, again, is about the size of its own little county, and it's just for retirees. It's just people. Originally, it was just people 65 plus, but it has grown so much they had to start letting younger people. And now I understand they have a high school and schools because it's gotten so large. But it began as a place just for retirees, and that goes on today in different parts of the state. And it really has filled a lot of the area of, you know, that probably when you were initially here was open areas, now retirement villages.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. Of course, I can say the same thing about the state of Washington, and I live here. I mean, it's just amazing to me, the growth and development. It all has to do with population. One of the comments that you bring out And this is an ecological situation, and that is the challenge with sinkholes. Now, interestingly, Florida isn't the only one that's going through this, and it has to do with our water table diminishing significantly under a developed area. And all of a sudden, kaboom, there's nothing there. Nothing has filled that void, and whatever, a little earthquake, something moving, too much weight on the earth above, all of a sudden, kaboom, those sinkholes happen. And you've got a picture here of an advertisement. It's huge, the sinkholes. And it gives the name of the attorney's firm. Call 1-800 and the firm's name, and we'll talk to you about sinkholes. And I'm going, holy Moses, here we go. This is a phenomena. But this has really become quite a concern, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's surprising how many of those billboards you see when you drive around that they're for sinkhole attorneys. It's like I said, there's an aquifer beneath the state, but we have a very unique geology. It's limestone underneath all the sand, and so it's like Swiss cheese where there's big pockets. And in times of drought or when there's excessive pumping of groundwater, the caverns that hold the water dry up. And there's nothing holding up the weight of the land mm-hmm. above that cavern caves in, and that's what forms a sinkhole. So there's a real well-known example. There's big strawberry farms near Plant City where the strawberries are usually harvested around February, and it was winter, and it was a big freeze was coming. So they to protect their crops, they had their sprinklers on for like a week straight through the night to protect their crops. As a result, so much water was taken out of the aquifer that something like 80-some sinkholes developed and people's wells dried up, and the results were catastrophic. And stuff like that continues to this day. I'm sure you heard the news about that poor fella who was swallowed up by a sinkhole earlier this year, and they were never able to recover him.
Mm-hmm. Boy, it sure does bring home so much awareness of how we need to really be alert to the environments that we're in, because we do things and it's not until something really grabs our attention we go, oh my goodness, maybe we need to do something a different way. Florida is absolutely gorgeous as a state, and I think it is an awesome place to vacation in. Of course, Florida is often the base point for cruises going out to the Caribbean and so many other activities. There's Disney World. There's just, it's just absolutely gorgeous down there. And your book, Finding the Fountain of Youth, Ponce de Leon and Florida's Magical Waters. Rick Kilby, you have done such a nice job at representing your state, even with some of the issues that are big challenges for them, but to bring forth the beauty and dispelling the myth of the Fountain of Youth, which I have to chuckle at. I think everybody's looking for that someplace, somewhere. And it's just a delight. You've done a wonderful job in all of the art and everything in it. It's so colorful. It's a wonderful addition to a library.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It was definitely a pleasure to put the book together, and I got to design it as well as write it. And I really do feel like there was a lot of serendipity involved with the project, and I thought I was going to self-publish it, and then just a series of remarkable events lined up so that it got published by a well-known Florida publisher. And I really feel like the project kind of was organic, and I was meant to do it, and a real joy, and I continue to love to talk about it and explore and find new artifacts.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what's your website so people can find out more about your research and your information, because it is a beautiful state?
It's floridasfountainofyouth.com.
floridasfountainofyouth.com. And, of course, the famous Seminole Indians live there, and so much other information that is American history that's absolutely wonderful. But this is so picturesque, and I love the cartoons. I just love all of these old pictures that you have, and the mermaids, and all of the swimming, and the various photographs that you've been able to dig up from the past, it all shows why it has become such a fabulous place for people to not just visit, but to even call home. And it's for people of all ages. It's just absolutely marvelous. Rick Kilby, thank you so much. I wish you nothing but success with the Fountain of Youth, your wonderful book you've put together.
Thank you very much, Donna.
Florida's Fountain of Youth, check it out. If you've ever wanted to visit the place, I think his website would enable you to figure out why you definitely should. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via Donna at DelphiInternational.com
or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. If you'd like to call in and chat with me, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Call me at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, here in summertime in the Pacific Northwest, one of the joys, I would say, that so many in my neighborhood experience is going out and picking blackberries. Now, I know you think that's probably silly, but I really mean it. We have blackberry bushes here in the Pacific Northwest where the vines are as thick as two fingers. They get that big. Depends on the amount of water that we get. But these things come out, and I'll never forget when I first came up to the Pacific Northwest, I was surprised at the size of blackberry. Well, where we were living when we first came up here was in Fife, Washington, and they had drainage ditches to handle the water runoff. I mean, they didn't have the sewage treatment and this kind of stuff that they implemented a short time later. And you just had some open areas of land. Those are all gone now. But by golly, these blackberries were as big as your thumb. They were huge. And I can remember making blackberry pies and all kinds of different yummy dishes with blackberries. And they were delicious, absolutely delicious. So here, now, they're starting to come out. And we have had an absolutely gorgeous spring and summer. And so I wanted to share with you a recipe for a blackberry pie, and I'll do that later on. But if you had a chance just to get out and to do any berry picking, I don't know what might be in your neighborhood, but it really is a way to relax, believe it or not. Now, with blackberry bushes, you got to watch it because they have a tendency to sort of grab you. They have spines on them like crazy. And you never want to fall into a blackberry patch because, believe me, it was not a fun experience. I had a friend that went through something like that. She never forgot it. Anyway, they're coming out here, and I have got some awesome recipes. And I was out, and I was, even though it's just the first bloom of them, and they'll be blooming for the next couple of weeks and just budding out and turning into those luscious berries. But I like making preserves with them. And during the winter months, there's nothing like using those fresh berries. So I'll be sharing, though, a blackberry pie recipe with you in just a little bit. You might want to have your pad of paper and pen handy. But before that, I wanted to talk to you about some laser cowboys. Now, the reason I found this so interesting is that so many things that we have seen in sci-fi movies that Gene Roddenberry started with Star Trek, we've had Star Wars, we've had all kinds of things that have portrayed different components. Well, in Star Wars, when there was a certain portion of the film, they used holographic imagery or portrayed that as a way of receiving a message. It was put into I'll call it a memory stick of type. And they plugged it into an apparatus, and bingo, there was the person in the hologram talking and giving information. Well, there are two men who are very, very much involved with the Smithsonian Institution. And this is what they're doing. They're transforming artifacts into printable 3D models. Now, this technology is really advancing, and it's so significant because it's going to enable you to, if you're a student, if you're curious about anything, you're going to be able to look at it all the way around. Now, there was a sculptor by the name of Clark Mills who in 1865 created a life mask of Abraham Lincoln. Now, this is how he did it. He smeared the president's face with oil and wet plaster. Now, Vince Rossi and Adam Metallo are the two men that are working with the Smithsonian. They are in charge of their 3D lab in the digitization program office. They were able to use laser scanners to create a detailed computer model of the life mask, and it can be used to print plastic or metal replicas at any scale. Well, that's a commercial value. These two men have really worked on transforming old techniques into more refined ones so that they can get high resolution in virtual models of whatever they want to copy. And it took them just 2 hours. It took longer than that for the gentleman, Clark Mills, who did the Lincoln life mask, for him to do that in the 1800s. Well, here we are where they did the actual measurement, got all the information, all the finite details with a laser beam scanner. And so here they are. They are working. They're artists of a type. But it was 2009 when they found that they really wanted to get involved with 3D scanning. And both of these men had been working together, and they would just go out and buy whatever technology had come out where they could experiment with it. And I've got a picture of the two men. Adam Metallo was trained as a painter, and Vince Rossi is a sculptor. This is what they do in their real-world life experience. And he said that today they are really enjoying what they had spent hours of practice in doing, and that was making models for exhibits during the day and scanning on nights and weekends. Now, their most challenging undertaking was in 2011, and they traveled to Chile, where they digitized 8 well-preserved prehistoric whale skeletons. Those things are huge. And they recorded their precise locations in the ground prior to excavating the bones. And they have actually been able to get printed scaled-down versions of the site for closer study. Can you imagine what this is going to do to the field of archaeology? You're going to have virtual archaeology. Yes, and there we go with Star Trek. Stepping into something, turning on the computer, saying, I want this, that, or the other. And you've got the environment down to the thumbtack that you want recreated. Now, they say they want to expand public access to the 137 million objects in the Smithsonian, and less than 2% of these artifacts can be displayed at any time, and you're not going to be able to even see them in person most of the time. Think of that. You're going to be able to have access, because of this sophistication of technology, to see these things. You'll be able to do it on the Internet. You'll be able to see it at the museum. And so many times, artifacts are fragile. So when they're able to digitize them and create the 3D models, they'll still be able to protect them, but people will be able to actually work with them. And they said also, precise replicas could be printed and sent to the local museums around the world. And just as I said, you could see them on your computer screen. Now, right now, these two laser cowboys are scanning the Natural History Museum's Dinosaur Hall because it's going to be going through a renovation in 2014. So this is what they're doing, a digital archive of the current exhibit, and then what's going to come out of what their work creates, they said they're going to create new poses for the massive skeletons that will be taken apart because of the renovation. And it's going to be a lot easier for paleontologists to do your work. And there's one specimen that they've got on display that's 2 stories high. So now, instead of someone having to get up on a scissor lift to look at it, all they have to do is email a digital model. Unbelievable. But the thing is, when you imagine something, when it is conceived in the mind, usually it can be achieved in physical reality. But just like these two young men have found, it takes some practice. And that's exactly what we need to realize with our own lives. We need to realize that it's practical experience often that enables us to see what our strengths and weaknesses are and where our passions lie. And then we can expand into areas that will allow us to perhaps, just like with these two guys, utilize technology to enable us to do what we love the most. Fascinating times we're living in, aggravating in some respects, but fascinating in others. Donna Sebo here, and if you want to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into. And I had to chuckle. I saw a cartoon this morning when I was getting ready for the show, and it was showing a car driving down a road, obviously a family going on vacation, and the caption was at the bottom, the mother talking to one of the kids sitting in the back seat. And what she said basically is, if you tweet me one more time, are we there yet? I'm throwing your cell phone out the window. Oh, my goodness. Sitting in a car, backseat, front seat, you're using the little cell phone to communicate, sending little messages. Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable. But that's the age that we live in. Live in the sunshine. Swim the sea. Drink the wild air. Ah, yes. Ralph Waldo Emerson said those beautiful words, and I concur. Live in the sunshine, swim the sea, and drink the wild air. Yes, it absolutely is invigorating, and you do feel so much better after you do. And not only that, it relaxes you. That's why Florida has always been such a popular place. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. If you want to chat, 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm going to be giving you a recipe for fresh blackberry pie. It's real simple, but oh, it is so good. But before I do, I want to let you know tomorrow we're going to be talking with Dr. Wiley, and we're going to be talking about how to power up your health. This is a man who has interacted with thousands of people, and he and Danny Torres have put together some wonderful information, and we're going to be sharing that with you tomorrow. We all want to be living better and healthier. Isn't that the reality? Well, he's going to be sharing some tips tomorrow. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Dennis Kingsley in Spain, New Science and Spirituality. Now, this is a book that was put together with very, very well-known people, Deepak Chopra and so many others, that just wrote a short essay on how they are seeing science and spirituality coming into a continuum of compatibility. So many times there's a war that's been declared, which is ridiculous, but that's just the nature of human beings, and I think of the two ivory tower positionings that so often are taken. And I think you'll find this interesting. So we will have those individuals on this week, and we've got a great lineup for the rest of the month. So check show information so you find out who is coming up. Okay, blackberries. Now, I want you to know, you could also, if raspberries are coming up, because raspberries are here as well in the Pacific Northwest, we have big farms for that. You have the berries that come out, and berries are loaded with nutrition. And I'll share with you a story after I give you the recipe about how, well, I'll show it with you after I give you the recipe. Blackberry pie. You're going to need a quart of fresh blackberries. Of course, you want to rinse them off, and you want to drain them. And this is because you're going to be using a pie. You want to make sure that you have a strainer that's like a fine mesh that you put them in. You don't want to handle them a whole bunch because you don't want them bruised, and you don't want their natural juices going out of the berries. So it's just a light rinse, and you're ready to go. And then you're going to need 1.5 cups of sugar. 1.5 cups of sugar. Yes, this is the real stuff. We're not going to use any artificial stuff. We're going to use the real thing. 1.5 cups of sugar, 1/8 teaspoon of salt, 1.5 tablespoons of all-purpose flour, and then use your favorite pastry, whatever you like to use for a crust. And that's going to be for a 9-inch pie. And you're going to need about 1 tablespoon of butter. And if you are lazy and you say, I don't have the time, Donna, to do all the homemade pastry stuff, great. Go to your grocery store, the freezer section, and get the pre-made pie crust. You can use those because you can roll them out. Now, your blackberries, you want to mix them with the sugar, the salt, and the flour. Now, some people like to use tapioca or arrowroot instead of the flour. You can experiment if you've got a lot of blackberries, but you might just want to try it with the flour the first time you make it. Otherwise, substitute the tapioca or the arrowroot. Some people like to use cornstarch, but dependent on the amount of juice that's in your berries, depends on how much you're going to need. I've baked blackberry pies that were so loaded. The berries were so full of juice. By the time I finished baking, I said, where were the berries? Because the juice just exploded out of the berries. It was delicious. But you know how you see so many of these with the berries stacked real high? Well, it takes more than a quart. But anyway, you're going to put your pastry in your pie pan, 9-inch pie pan, and you want to dot it with butter, or put your berries right inside the pastry-lined pan. Excuse me, I didn't say that correctly. Dot it with butter, put your top crust up on top of the berries, and I like to take a beaten egg, and then I brush the top of the crust and the edging of the crust with the beaten egg because it gives this beautiful golden look to the crust. And I also take a little bit of extra sugar and I sprinkle it on the top. I know. These are just Donna tips. Anyway, you're going to have this put in, you're going to put your pie into a very hot oven that's preheated to 450 degrees. Now, you have to set the timer. You want to do it for 10 minutes and then you want to reduce the heat. Don't open the oven door. Reduce your heat to 350 degrees and bake it 25 minutes longer. That's how simple this is. And it goes great with ice cream. I mean, whipped cream doesn't make any difference. But allow your pie, obviously, to cool. And if you're really, really lazy and you really don't want to be bothered with making a double crust pie, make a single crust. Have a deep dish, 2-quart dish. Put one crust on the top. Brush it, like I said, with beaten eggs to get that golden look. Put a little sugar on it. Put all your mixture of the berries in below. Spray the dish with some nonstick cooking spray, or use some coconut oil if you want, and just make sure, because it will stick. So if you have that, then it won't stick. It'll come out real easily. And that's the lazy person's way of doing it. That's a deep dish pie. Oh, it's so good. And what I do also, I add a little bit of cinnamon. Yes, I add cinnamon, and sometimes I like to add almonds, and sometimes I'll mix almonds in with the pie crust. Oh, I know, I love to bake, absolutely love to bake. But this is a real simple recipe, and you can use it for your other berries, too. Now, sometimes berries are really, really tart, so you may want to adjust the sugar level that you're going to use, but it really is a winner. I was going to tell you something about berries, and this is a true story. I was traveling in Alaska, and I met this woman who, along with her husband, had decided they were going to be in outlying areas, and they were going to be up to their nose in snowdrifts and then some during the winter months. Uh-oh, I'm looking at the clock. I've got to tell you this story tomorrow. But anyway, it's about how berries kept them healthy during winter up in the far north. I'll give you that information tomorrow. My goodness, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm delighted we've been able to spend this time together. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless, and I hope you'll join me tomorrow. We've got good things to share with you. This is Donna. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.